Hello, good afternoon. Thank you for joining this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation here in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. My name is John Matlock, Director of External Relations and Outreach here at Perimeter Institute. It's my pleasure to welcome you and to everybody tuning us in on your desktops at home or at the office. This lecture series is presented by KPMG. We'd like to thank KPMG very much for their wonderful support of the entire festival and this series in particular and their interest in science communication. I would also like to thank our presenting media partner, TVO, for facilitating much of the technology and production crew that make all the streaming and broadcasts possible. They're just tremendous media partners here at Q2C, as well as Stream the World and many other supporters that are making all of this possible. Before we begin the lecture, I would ask that those of you in theater kindly turn off your BlackBerries or other cell phone devices. Those of you at home, this is the right time to share the Q2C link with your friends or family if you'd like them to tune in this particular lecture online. It's about to begin. And you can also submit your questions online by using the blogs that are facilitated on the various websites. And our Jennifer Dodd will collect your questions here in the theater and relay them to our guest speaker. Those of you here at PI, if you do have a question, I would ask that you work your way down the steps. At the end of the presentation, we'll have a microphone just next to the podium. I'll also ask that you keep your questions concise and on topic so that we can facilitate as many questions as we can possibly get through in the time that we have to share together. Now, before we begin, we have word of a new award to share with you that is of tremendous importance to all of us involved with scientific outreach across Canada. Allow me to introduce Robert Mann, President of the Canadian Association of Physicists, and Tim Meyer, Head of Strategic Planning and Communications at Triumph in Canada, with a very interesting announcement. Rob.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here representing the Canadian Association of Physicists. We at the CAP, as we like to call ourselves, have long recognized and appreciated the very challenging and rewarding job that teachers have in teaching physics to high school students. For many people, in fact, almost everyone has their first genuine exposure to physics at the high school level. It's a challenging subject. It's also a rewarding one. And we at the CAP are pleased to partner with these organizations you see before you to initiate an award for excellence in teaching high school physics. This award will be offered annually 5 times in 5 different regions of the country: BC, Yukon, the Prairies and the Northwest Territories, Ontario, Quebec and Nunavut, and Atlantic Canada. And in each of those regions, we will recognize those teachers of high school physics that have truly been able to motivate their students to excellence. Details of nomination procedures will be found on the CAP website, www.cap.ca. To those of you that have taught high school physics in the past or that may be currently teaching it now, our heartfelt thanks and appreciation. You are training the minds of tomorrow. The students in your classroom will become the scientists that make breakthrough discoveries of the type that we see here at Perimeter and that will implement the principles of physics in medicine, in optics, in materials, and in so many other applications we see in our world that enhance the quality of our lives. So, please go to our website for further details on our award for excellence in teaching high school physics.
So good afternoon. I'm here from Triumph, and you might ask, what is Triumph and why are we here? So Triumph is located in Vancouver, British Columbia. It's Canada's national laboratory for particle and nuclear physics. And the weather is sometimes better in Waterloo, but not always. So Triumph is owned by a consortium of 15 universities around Canada. So as a national laboratory, we're already involved in doing physics within Canada, for Canada, and actually helping Canadians work at projects in CERN, at CERN in Geneva, Switzerland, with the Large Hadron Collider, as well as the T2K neutrino project in Japan. So Triumph is deeply committed to moving physics forward for Canada and providing a platform for innovation and commercialization. Now, Triumph also recognizes that physics is an enterprise that actually provides direct value to Canada, and it's exciting those young minds that come up with the new ideas, the new applications, the new ways to teach physics, and the new ways of sharing physics that really makes Canada one of the greatest nations. So as part of our commitment to delivering value to Canada, we're here and we're really proud to be a sponsor of this national award for identifying those teachers who first touch our minds and our hearts to take up the cause of physics and to share it with everyone else. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Robert and Tim, for this long overdue awards program for educators across the country. We're very happy to partner with them on this project and announce it here at Q2C. It is now my pleasure to introduce Larry Abbott. Dr. Abbott is the William Bleuler Professor of Theoretical Neuroscience of Columbia University. He studies the brain using computational modeling and mathematical analysis of neurons and neural networks. He joins us right now to show how our brains make sense from chaos. Please welcome Professor Abbott.
Thank you. Thanks. So for the next little while, I'd like to talk to you about modeling this system. Modeling a brain is hard and it's intimidating. So I want to start the initial part of my lecture just by talking to you about the challenges, how this is the same as modeling other physical systems and how it's different. Then get into the actual modeling that we do, which is not really honestly modeling the whole brain, but modeling bits and pieces of it. But nevertheless, even modeling bits and pieces of a brain is very difficult. So I want to introduce another system that has undoubtedly been discussed in this festival, and that is the subject of modeling, namely something like a galaxy. So to start, I want to just talk a little bit about the similarities and the differences in modeling something like a brain or modeling something like a galaxy. So let's start with a similarity. If you count their elements as opposed to looking at their size, brains and galaxies are sort of the same size. They have 100 billion elements. In the case of a brain, it's the nerve cells or neurons that make up the brain. In the case of a galaxy, it's stars. So they're both very large systems if you start writing down the component parts. Now, here's a place where they differ. If you start thinking about a galaxy and how it's put together, how it evolves, things like that, clearly something that's going to be very important to you are the forces between the elements, between the stars. And here, in the case of a galaxy, you kind of luck out. And that is because if you know the mass of two stars and you know the distance between them, you know the gravitational force. That's what's been achieved by our theories of gravity. And that means that if you know where the stars are and how much they weigh, that's still a lot of information, and we'll get to that in a second. But if you know that, in a sense, the interactions between these stars come for free because they're given by functions of those variables, the masses and the distance between the elements. What about in a brain? Well, here are two neurons you see in the picture. They interact as well, and their interactions also depend on their identity, the same way that the interaction between a pair of stars depends on their mass, on properties of the stars. But they don't only depend on that. They also, for example, depend on the distance between the neurons, as they do in the stars. But there's a lot more that they depend on. And therefore, just knowing, if I know all the properties of those two neurons in the picture there, just knowing that is not going to tell me how they interact. So then you have to know about the interaction, something that you don't have to list with a galaxy. And now the numbers get truly stupendous. In your brain, there are something like 1,000 trillion synapses. 1,000 trillion probably has a name, but I wasn't quite sure what it was when I made this slide. So now the number of variables just exploded on you because the interactions aren't for free, that you have to think about them independently. And during my talk, you'll see that coming up as a theme, a problem that we have to deal with, and something that we have to think about. Okay, what about a similarity? I already mentioned that these systems are huge in terms of their numbers. No one is going to expect an astrophysicist to tell you what every star in a galaxy is doing, and you wouldn't want to sit around for that lecture anyway. So what we do in terms of galaxies is think about a distribution of mass within the galaxy and make a kind of a population statistical description of the whole thing. And I think that is also appropriate for brains. You don't want me to tell you what every neuron in a brain is doing either. I couldn't get it in the time allotted. So we're going to talk about distributions of the properties of neurons, distribution of synaptic strengths, which is the connections between neurons. Those are called synapses. I didn't mention that before. But and their strengths are vitally important to how a brain works. So we'll talk about those in terms of distributions, and you'll see that coming along. All right. Now, what about a difference? If you try to think about just modeling a galaxy, the piece of the puzzle that you don't know, you may know the mass distribution in the galaxy, you know about gravity, you know a lot of things, but you really don't know what happened when this galaxy was first born. You don't necessarily know the initial conditions. Now, if you want to make an astrophysicist miserable, you just tell her that that galaxy there resulted from very, very special initial conditions, namely, if you don't know what every little particle of matter was doing, you know, billions of years ago when that galaxy formed, you're not going to get it right. If that's true, astrophysicists are in incredible trouble, because how are we going to ever know those initial conditions? Instead, what an astrophysicist will assume is that they're kind of generic initial conditions. There was some kind of big cloud of matter, a perturbation in the matter distribution of the early universe that through gravity that grew, stars formed, et cetera, and that galaxy formed as a kind of a generic process. Well, what about a brain? We know that a brain has access not only to initial conditions, whatever happened when you were, you know, your body first started growing, but also to a huge amount of information through the genetic code. And so it's much less clear with a brain that you can think of it. Of course, it's not just a generic structure. It's not your average lump of matter. But how special is it? For example, is every connection in there specified with great accuracy? If that's true, we're in trouble, because we're not going to be able to build a model where every single connection is described perfectly. So this is a troublesome feature of modeling, which again, I'll discuss as we go along. Now, another element here that you have to think about is, what are you trying to explain? So let me put up the list for galaxy. If you look at this picture of a galaxy, everybody in the audience can come up with a good question. Probably the first question you would say is, why does it have that amazing shape? Why does it have those huge spiral arms and the bar between the middle? How do you get a group of stars to form a shape like that? Where did this thing come from? How did it form? Is it going to be this way for a long time, or is that shape going to fall apart? Is it stable or not? How did those stars get created in those arms? And you know, is there a black hole in the middle? There are lots of questions that arise directly from that picture and the distribution of matter, the way light comes out of this galaxy. Now, you could also all come up with great questions about a brain, but I would bet that all of them were not about what's pictured there. You would not ask me, why does it have the shape that it does? It's not the most interesting thing you can think of about a brain. Instead, the thing that's interesting about a brain is it's in a person or it's in an animal. And that means for a modeler that you say, well, even if I can model the brain, do I need to now model the whole animal and its behavior in order to see if my model produces anything realistically? Again, I'll talk as we go along about how we deal with that problem. But these last two things are big problems that I don't want to sweep under the rug. All right. Now, I've introduced you to one of the difficult characters, but also one of the heroes, sort of the brain, which are these synapses, the connections between nerve cells. The average nerve cell in your brain has about 10,000 connections to other nerve cells. The brain is a highly connected, highly interactive system. And here are some pictures of synapses, just as by way of introduction. So what you see on the left there is a neuron, beautifully stained in a brain. And what you see slightly to the right, these little bumps coming off are spines. Those are the site of excitatory synapses in the brain. So fibers from other neurons, which you can't see in this picture because they haven't been stained, will travel across the brain and make contacts at those spines. Now, in the rightmost picture, what you see is an EM, electromicrograph, of a spine. So I don't know if I can't really point to it here, but that big column going down is similar to the shafts that you see in the neuron on the left, and that little bump to the right with a star on it, that's a spine, and the little black sort of smudge at the end of that, that's a synapse. That's a connection where the process from one neuron releases a transmitter. Transmitter goes to the other neuron, and they communicate. That's the way one neuron in your brain communicates to another. It's also how neurons in your body communicate to your muscles, and the whole system works basically by that principle. I like the picture on the right because it reminds you of what a difficult problem we have here. This picture is just chock full of stuff, as you can see. Our brains are just jammed with fibers, with connections, with dendrites, which are the incoming elements of neurons, with axons, which are their outgoing elements. Just jam-packed. It looks like a gigantic bowl of spaghetti, and yet somehow it works, and we'll talk about that. Okay, I have to introduce you to another thing from neuroscience, just in case you don't know, which are the elements by which this communication occurs. I've told you that synapses are the site of the communication, how one neuron communicates to another. But what is the signal? The signal is what's called an action potential, and what you're seeing here are recordings from a neuron, which is firing a sequence of action potentials. Those are those spikes that you see in the diagram. The one on the left is firing a little bit more slowly than the one on the right, as you can tell by the density of those spikes. That's how your neurons communicate with each other. That's how you communicate to your muscles. That's how information from the periphery, for example, from your eyes, is communicated to your brain. The whole system works with these spikes. Or action potentials. When a spike arrives at a synapse, it induces a transmission that carries the signal from one neuron to another. So that's the commodity by which we think, by which we move, by which we perceive the world. And as a result, it's of course going to be a big element in my talk. Now, I'm going to represent these action potentials in different ways, as neuroscientists do. So I want to introduce you to that so you don't get confused, because I'm always talking about the same thing, but it may not be apparent. This is one picture of an action potential. This is the picture that you would get if you could actually stick an electrode into a cell and record the voltage inside that cell compared to the voltage outside. You would get a picture like this. Sorry, I think I must have just bumped my flicker. Okay, now often, since, as I said, the action potentials, these spikes, are the important element, I will simplify matters and just draw the spikes. So here's a sequence of spikes. It doesn't correspond to the picture on the top, but just a sequence of spikes. But the rest of that potential that you see at the top has just been eliminated. That actually is something commonly seen in neuroscience as well, because if you take an electrode and you put it beside a nerve cell but actually don't puncture the nerve cell, then you see a sequence of spikes like that. That's what you see. Now, I'll often also use what is much more like a theorist's construction, which is to plot the rate at which these spikes are being generated by a cell as a wiggly line like that. So that line signifies that a cell is sometimes firing spikes at a rapid rate. A rapid rate for a neuron would be something like 100 times per second or 200 times per second, 200 of these spikes every second. When it drops, it may go down to a few spikes per second, one or two. That's a slow firing rate. And so the bottom is a sort of more abstract version of the pictures on the top, and we'll see those pictures coming back during the course of the talk. All right, so here's our problem. Now, I did confess at the top that we're probably not going to model the whole brain. That's a tall order. We're going to model a piece of it, a neural circuit that does some aspect of thinking, of perception, of motion. And those circuits look like this. They're incredibly dense arrays of neurons and connections. And so we build models of them. The models are simplified, but we hope to catch the spirit of what's in the picture on the left, which is a real brain, and what's on the right, which is obviously just a simple diagram. So what do we do? This diagram up there is for two purposes. One is to introduce my colleagues. You can look at them and admire them and see their names. They're very good colleagues, and that's who I've done the work with. But the other is to tell you a little bit about how we build these models. So within this little symbolic diagram, the circles represent neurons. So what do we have to do to model a neuron? Basically, we need some mathematical equations that describe how do neurons receive these signals from other neurons. Whenever another neuron fires an action potential or a spike, that neuron has to receive things. So we need to build that into the model. That's something that's well understood and can be well described. Next, we need to say how the signals from many different cells are added up. Because I mentioned to you that a single neuron will receive input from something like 10,000 others. So not only do we have to introduce those inputs into our model, we have to add them up and figure out what the total is. And then, of course, our model neuron has to generate these spikes or action potentials so it in turn can communicate with other neurons down the road. And so we need a mechanism to take that summed input, decide whether the neuron is going to spike, and produce that action potential. These are all things that can be modeled in great detail. We know a lot about this aspect of the brain. Our models often simplify that just because we have only so much computer capacity and we can't spend a huge amount of time modeling one neuron if we want to model a whole big circuit. So we often simplify it, but I would say we have a pretty good understanding of these things. Our understanding is always growing, but not bad. Okay, so that's what we do. And then we have to hook these guys up. That's what the little lines with arrows represent in this diagram. The fact that we have connections between these cells and they are what make the network work. That's where things get tricky. Because I mentioned to you that unlike the case of the galaxy, these connections are not for free. Just because we know the identity of two neurons doesn't mean we know how they're connected. We don't even know whether they're connected. So we need further information to specify the strengths of these connections, what type of connection it is, what effect one cell will have on the other. That is an enormous amount of information. I gave you this number of 1,000 trillion at the beginning. It's an enormous amount of information, and it's information about which we don't have a whole lot of data. It's very difficult to measure these connections. To measure them in bulk is extraordinarily hard. So we're kind of faced with the fact of having to explore that on our own. Of course, that's where us theorists make our money. Now, I shouldn't say we know nothing, because here's a nice diagram from some data, which is distributions. Remember when I at the beginning of the talk, I told you about the fact that in a large system, like a brain or a galaxy, you're not going to go and describe every element individually. You're going to describe distributions, mass distributions if it's a galaxy, and if it's a synapse, distributions of strengths. And here's some data on that. So this diagram shows you a distribution of how frequently these people found synapses of different strengths. Now, here's an idealized version of it that I can discuss in a little more. So on the axis, x-axis here, horizontal axis, so I have synaptic strength, and I've divided the synapses into two types, which is what the brain does. There are excitatory synapses. Those are synapses that allow one cell to have a positive effect on another cell. In other words, if the first cell fires, the second cell is more likely to fire an action potential itself when they're connected with an excitatory synapse. We also have in the brain inhibitory synapses that have the opposite effect. When the first neuron fires, it suppresses the ability of the second neuron to fire an action potential. So it has a negative impact on it. So unlike gravity, which is always an attractive force, we have both positive and negative influences in neuroscience. And then I've just schematically drawn some distributions, which again say how many synapses are really strong. Those would be the ones on the far right of this diagram. How many synapses are weak? Those would be the ones in near zero in this diagram, and obviously there's some kind of distribution. This distribution is something we can get experimentally. That's what the diagram on the top right is supposed to convince you of. So you know, we can do something with it. But the issue where we started our investigations was to say, what elements of this distribution are important? What makes the brain work roughly the way it does, and then even if we're lucky, what makes it work specifically the way it does? So let me give you some ideas about that. Let me just go back for 1 second. So suppose we take our favorite distribution of synapses and we built a model, because that was the only element that's left. Remember, I described to you, we can model the neurons. We can model the communication between the neurons. We just didn't know what strengths to set them. But if I give you that distribution, I can draw a random numbers from that distribution. I can set all the synapses. I've got myself a circuit. So I'm raring to go. I say, good, you know, I'm going to write a great paper and become famous. The trouble is, when you do that, often, when you build the model, it doesn't do anything. And I'll show you that in a second, that sad fact. So then what do, right? You panic, you get another career, or you start fiddling with the model, okay? You say, I must not have got the distribution quite right. Now, the most thing that you might think of doing, if your model's doing absolutely nothing, is say, you know, juice this thing up a little bit. Let's make all the synapses, you know, more excitatory. So that would correspond, and you take this distribution and move it to the right. And I would say, I would have said this a year or 2 years ago. I think most neuroscientists would say, that's what to do. If your model's boring, you know, crank up the gas and let's see what happens. I will show you in a second that's not a good idea. It doesn't do anything interesting. It does something to the model, but it doesn't make it look like a brain. So that's a bad idea. Well, you might have another idea. Let's just make everybody stronger. Instead of, you know, pushing everybody up to the right like I did on the last slide, what if you just made all the excitatory synapses stronger? You make all the inhibitory ones stronger. You just, you know, crank up the gas both ways. It's kind of a contradictory thing. It's sort of like taking a person and pulling them in two directions. But, you know, that does produce an effect. So maybe it'll work. It doesn't work. What works is making more variability. And this is something that, for a modeler, is a real lesson. You know, people who build models, they like to make them simple. So the first thing you might say is, you know, these synapses, they're so complicated, I'm just going to make them all the same. That's a disaster. The key to making an interesting circuit is to have a lot of variability in the synapses, to make some of them strong, some of them weak, and have as much of a spread as possible. And I would say, you know, this isn't the only reason that your brain is an interesting device, but one of the reasons is that you have this tremendous variety in the synapses and indeed in the neurons. And these models really point out that isn't just, you know, biology being its usual confusing self. It's an essential element of how these brains work. And so let me show you that in action. Rather than listen to me, you can see it happen. So I have a couple of models to run here. Let me start with this one. This is a model. Let me just tell you what you're going to see before I run it. This is a model with a lot of neurons in it, but I can't show them all to you. And so I'm just taking 3 random neurons and showing them to you. But these are typical neurons, so I'm not distorting the picture. These neurons are going to do pretty much what all the other ones do. Second, this is a model, again, where I'm going to show you the firing rate of these neurons. You won't see the individual spikes in this particular demo. You'll see lines that depict how rapidly those spikes are occurring. And the scale here goes from 0 to 1 because it's drawn from, obviously, no spikes being produced, and 1 represents the maximum firing rate of the neuron. And if you want a real number, you can think of that as 1 or 100 or 200 hertz, 200 per second, something like that. All right, so here's where I'm going to start the demo. And this is the example of what I said. This is how not to be a successful scientist, to show pictures like this. This is the network doing absolutely nothing. But this is, you know, what happens if you just pick a random distribution, what can happen, and you say, you know, this is not a model of the brain, this is a model of death. So what do you do? Well, I'm going to show you the effect of those arrows that I showed you, move everybody to the right, move everybody to the left, do something like that. So when I push this little button here that you see, that's what I'm doing, okay? I move everybody to the right, and, well, something happened, right? It changed. I have more excitation in the network. So now the firing rates aren't all zero, they're non-zero. So I got a little bit, but this is not your brain, you know? Maybe you're not dead, but you're in bad shape if this is what your brain's doing. By the end of the talk, this is your brain, but hopefully not yet, okay? So that doesn't work. Now, this other button over here is the one that introduces more variability into the network, okay? So I'll click it once. Well, we added some variability, but nothing happened. But watch what happens when I do it again. Pow, the thing comes to life. Now I have a rich dynamic system. This is actually a chaotic system, which is the chaos from my title. And although, you know, this is not a brain doing a coherent thing, it's at least we're in the ballpark. We now have a rich dynamical system. It's got lots of structure to it. We got something to work with. We're in the ballpark. And that was a crucial observation. Not just made by us, I should acknowledge, but that's the trick. Now, let me show you another version of that demo in its final guise, but with the spikes added, because this is kind of an instructive thing. This is just a model. It's running in real time. It's not a movie. It's running in real time on my computer. And this really does look what's happening in your brain. If I could tell you what neurons in your brain were doing right now, I would get a picture that will look pretty much like this. So let me show you what you're looking at. The top panel is a representation of these action potentials for 100 neurons. Again, I can't show you thousands and thousands of cells. There's not enough room on the screen. But for 100 neurons, each black or red or blue line you're seeing is one of these action potentials. You're seeing 10 seconds of time. And of course, it's going on and on. And the three colors just represent three different types of neurons. It kind of doesn't matter what they are. The top, the red, are inhibitory neurons. The black are excitatory neurons. And the blue are a special kind of excitatory neuron that fires a little bit faster. Anyway, if I could look at 100 neurons in your brain now, my guess is they'd look pretty much like that. In other words, very rich structure. If you notice, some of these cells are firing slowly, then all of a sudden they come to life, then they get slow again. Very complicated structures. The picture at the bottom of the screen is one neuron in this, what we call intracellular form, where you can see the whole voltage. So if I could, you know, stick an electrode not only into your brain, but into one of the neurons in your brain, something I would not suggest you allow me to do, then you would see something like in the bottom. But what I want to show you, what you want to pick up here is this rich dynamic structure. There's complicated things going on. And this model is a simple model. After all, I can run it on my laptop right in front of your eyes. It has no random numbers in it. It's completely a set of deterministic equations grinding away. And it does this rich stuff, which is not really a bad model of a brain not doing anything. Okay, so as I said, we've gotten ourselves into the ball game. We have a brain just at rest, if you want, and we have something that kind of looks at it. Now, we got a long way to go because, after all, a brain doing nothing is not the most interesting thing in the world. It's a brain doing something that's interesting, but it's a start. Okay, so I showed you these. What I want to show you now is some experimental data. Because what I've been arguing is that the models that I've showed you thus far, models that do something like this. This is just the same thing I showed you, but in a still picture. Models like this are models for what we call spontaneous activity in a brain. If you take an animal where you actually can record neural activity, like a rat, and just have it sitting there not doing anything, not looking at anything, then you'll get activity like this. And that's what I want to show you. Here are another couple of colleagues whose names you can read and handsome pictures you can look at, who are involved in experiments. These are experiments where neurons are recorded in a rat's brain, either while it does nothing or while it's looking at a visual stimulus. So we can contrast a brain sort of doing nothing. These recordings are made in visual cortex. So when you're just in a blacked out room, your visual cortex is not particularly doing anything. Contrast that with when the rat is receiving a visual stimulus and therefore is doing its visual thing. And the way I want to show you this data is to look at it in chunks like this. You see if that brown box, that reflects looking at the activity of one of these recorded neurons over a particular period of time, and we do that over and over again over across the course of the experiment. The way we can do that, then, is to count the number of spikes in each of those brown boxes and look at how variable that is. That's what I'm interested in now, because the thing that I got excited on at any rate when I saw those simulations that I just showed you is how incredibly variable the responses are. Sometimes you get lots of spikes, sometimes not at all. And we can look at that by scanning these brown boxes. And then there's one other thing that we look at. We sometimes do it with bigger boxes or smaller boxes. So we can look at the variability on different time scales. And here's what we get. This is something called a Fano factor. If you don't know what it is, it doesn't matter. It's a measure of variability. How variable are these spike trains? If you want, how dynamically rich are they? And the x-axis is the size of the brown box. Are we looking at 1 second, 2 seconds, up to 10-second chunks? What you see is actually something very interesting. This is not a discovery of ours. This was known, but it's exhibited in this data. And that is that the larger timescales over which you look at neural activity, the more complicated it gets. That's this curve going up. So we have very rich structure in our neural activity, and over longer and longer timescales, it gets richer and richer. I don't actually have much to say about that, but it's an interesting fact. Now, what happens when you turn on a stimulus? Now, let me tell you first why we got interested in this. If you look at this spontaneous activity, or you look, for example, at the simulation I showed to you, I said, this is what your brain looks like. I didn't particularly say whether you're asleep and not listening to me or you're paying attention to me, because it doesn't matter. If one of you is paying careful attention to me, your neurons will look like that. If the next person is daydreaming and, you know, half asleep, it'll still look like that. Neural activity is not that different depending on what your brain is doing on a gross scale. But clearly, it's very different on a perceptual scale. And that got us very confused. If there's all this activity when, you know, like this, when you have blackness in the room, and then you turn on the lights, what happens? How is it that variability, that highly structured activity, doesn't get in the way of actually seeing things? And what we found in models, and then as you'll see right now in the data, is something very clever that neural circuits do. And that is that when a stimulus comes on, they automatically turn down the variability. So this measure of variability, although the shape is kind of the same, has suddenly been turned down. So what this means is that neural circuits, when they're engaged in activity, clearly they engage. But when they're not engaged, they don't shut down. They sort of twiddle their thumbs. That's what that top curve is. They just generate complicated activity. Maybe in the question period, we can get into why. You might say, why don't we just shut our brains down when we don't want to do anything? I have some ideas about that, but I don't think I'll mention it now. But they don't. Instead, neural circuits invent a little game for themselves, and that game is incredibly rich and structured, just as rich and structured as the activity they exhibit when they're actually doing something. But they get rid of that junk when the stimulus comes on, and that's why we can see. If it wasn't for that, we'd be constantly seeing all these fluctuations in addition to the real scene. So this is an interesting thing about how neural circuits work. Okay, so now I want to talk about another issue, though, which is, great, you know, I'm bragging to you about how proud I am that I can get a neural circuit to produce a mess, chaos, and you shouldn't be too impressed, to tell you the truth. You should say, let's see it do something useful, you know. If all you could do was produce chaos in your brain, you know, you'd be kind of like we all are, actually, but you know what I mean. You wouldn't be functioning very well. So that was the next project we did. We wanted to say, can we turn this chaos into something useful? Now we get into the problem of hooking this up to a person or an animal. This is just a neural circuit. It might be motor cortex, but it's not an animal. It's not a person. So how can we say, what is this thing doing? How can I point to that squiggly blue activity that's on this screen and say, that's not you walking down the street? Well, we take a shortcut here. And this shortcut is to extract a signal from these networks by a very simple process. All we do is we take each of those blue lines for every neuron in the network, we multiply it by a number, 3, 5, 7, -2, and we add the total up, and we produce a signal. Now, that is not how you walk down the street. The idea here is really just to define what a network is doing in such a way that we know it's the network that's doing it. We could put a very complicated readout device onto this network, but if we did that, how would we know that an interesting result wasn't a result of what we added and not the network? So this is a nice way, actually invented by some people I'll give credit to a little bit later, not by us, to really define, if you want, what is a neural circuit doing. So just, you know, let me do that. Okay, so suppose I do it for one of these networks. No matter how I pull this output out, all I get is chaotic wiggly lines. And let me define for you why that they are useless. It's not just that they're irregularly wiggling. And, you know, if I walk across the stage, I want to do it regularly. It's not just that. It's that chaotic activity is incredibly sensitive to how you start it off. Namely, if I, in my computer model, I produce this particular red curve that you see there. And if I wanted to do it again, and if I even started one of the neurons in my network just slightly different on the second trial, I would get a completely different red line. So the idea here is that even if I did somehow walk across the stage on the basis of that red line, I'd never be able to do it twice. I'd never be able to capture the conditions to produce that red line again. So this is unacceptable as a model of a brain actually doing something. This is, in my title, Sense from Chaos, this is just chaos from chaos at this point. So we got to do something. Now, probably everyone, and I would have said this a few years ago, say, well, change the model, you know, do something to it. Let's say make it do something regular. And mathematically, we could say, you know, suppose I want to make a triangle wave. You pick your favorite waveform, and I'll make it. Change something and do that. That's essentially the way neural networks were made for a long time. We don't always know how to do it. It's hard. But you might think of doing that. But I would like to persuade you why I think that's a bad idea. That's not the way to model this system. And again, gets into an element that I introduced at the beginning of the talk, which is the idea of genetics or evolution. So let's think a little bit about how neural circuits arise. At some point in evolution, there's some circuit that does something vital to an animal. All right? And then you want to start fooling with it, or evolution wants to start fooling with it. So you're allowed to fiddle with it, but you're not allowed to destroy it, because that circuit may be doing something very important for your life. You want to add a functionality, but you don't want to kill what you've already got. So you start fiddling with that circuit, but you don't destroy it. And then eventually you hijack it to a new purpose. Okay? I mean, suppose at some point, you know, an animal can walk at a certain speed, and suddenly by hijacking that circuit, you can run faster, something like that. That's how evolution proceeds. I think when we build models, we have to be aware of the fact that the system arose this way. And this is where it's different modeling a galaxy and a brain. At modeling a galaxy, you would say, look, if I know the laws of physics and I have some reasonable initial conditions, I'm just going to dive into it and go for it. You have to be more careful here, because I think you want to proceed to build your model along the same lines that nature built the thing you're modeling, namely the brain. So how do you do that? In a neural circuit, you want to start with something interesting, something that looks interesting. And what I've tried to persuade you up to now is that I think I've got that. I've got neural circuits that produce realistic-looking behavior. They're very complicated. They just aren't very useful. And then I want to fiddle with it. But following this idea of evolution, I don't really want to change it. I don't want to just go in and rebuild it by sort of a logical process. That's not what evolution does. I want to fiddle around. And then I want to hijack it, in this case, to a useful purpose. So how do we do that? We do that in the following way. We take the original circuit and completely leave it alone. We don't touch it. Instead, we append to it another loop. Okay? We take the activity out of that circuit, put it into another network, and shove it back. So we're only appending new stuff on. We're not changing the circuit. And then we do that in such a way that we get the activity that we want. And in this diagram, the lines that are red reflect connections that we have to adjust, if you want, intelligently. We have to adjust with care, or if we're talking about in the evolutionary perspective, things that would have to evolve to the right conditions. But all the black lines in the picture, the one that comes feeding back, the ones inside the circles, are completely random in our models. They can be anything you want. So this is, again, I think a hopeful sign, maybe if you want to call it a wishful sign, that we don't have to understand every connection to understand how these circuits work. We have to understand some connections, and the key is to figure out which ones they are. And at least in this model, it's the red ones and not the black ones. Okay, this is an idea. I wanted to give credit to Herbert Jaeger and Wolfgang Maas, who really have pursued this idea within computer science. In computer science, this is sometimes called reservoir computing. The idea here is that the big black circle, which was the network I started, is thought of as a dynamic reservoir. It's just a dynamic system that's complicated, that's interesting, and that seems rich enough to be worth fiddling with. And then the idea is you don't go and change it, but you try to pull out of it useful things. And obviously, this is an example of that. I think it's an idea because of this evolution connection that actually transfers quite nicely from computer science into neuroscience. All right, now, here's how this works, I think, in an evolutionary perspective. I've introduced one of these things. In our case, we started off with a circuit that didn't do anything and made it do something. Once it does something, you would say, well, can I keep going? Well, yes, you could. You could add more of these loops. Again, don't touch the original system. Don't touch the loop with the purple arrow. Just leave them alone, but add something new. And then keep doing it. The good thing about this is that when you add those new things, you're not destroying anything that you already had. So if your first circuit makes a triangle wave, you're never going to lose that triangle wave. We can't evolve or learn destructively, right? We have to keep adding things on and develop a repertoire. And so once these red lines have been appropriately adjusted, you'll have a system where if you activate different of these loops, so these purple arrows represent sort of activating the loop. If you activate these loops, you get a whole bunch of patterns. I'll show you this in the demo in a second. And if you're lucky, you might even have a case where after you're done, you can activate combinations of these things and get fortuitous interactions that give you even new things. So again, I think this is interesting from an evolutionary perspective, that you gradually add functionality, but every once in a while, you get lucky, and combinations of the pieces you add give you a whole new functionality that really evolution wasn't really aiming there, or evolution doesn't aim, but you know, was not subject to the evolutionary pressure, is kind of a free ride. Again, I think we need things like that to explain the incredible functionality that we get out of brains. We can't suppose that evolution builds them necessarily always one step at a time. There must be these fortuitous interactions that suddenly introduce new functionality. So let me show you a demo of that exact process. This is another one of these networks. I'll just start it off. This is another one of these networks in which the firing rates are being represented just by lines. And the output of the network, which was this what I called motor response, remember I had all these red lines coming out and a little yellow dot, that's the red curve at the top. That's what's coming out of this network. And this is where I started my discussion. Namely, this is a network that isn't doing anything. It's just doing its chaotic thing. That's what you see with the bottom blue lines are a number of neurons from this network, representative neurons, and the top is this output, which is just a chaotic mess. But now I've already built this system, so I'm going to activate one of the loops that we had designed. Suddenly, it's not chaotic anymore. It's a very regular pattern. We just made up this pattern. These are just mathematical patterns. I'll show you a more realistic motor example in just a little bit. But you know, you can obviously see it's a regular pattern. Now, let me activate another one of those loops. Again, you get a different pattern. Again, we just made this up, but now this network, same network, we're pulling out from the same basic chaotic structure now these non-chaotic, very regular signals. Here's another one. Here's another one. So it's kind of a funny little waveform. It'll get there eventually. It took a little while to get there. And then here's an interesting, that's just another one. I'm boring you with these, so let me get on to this. Here's another one that I think is kind of interesting. I've talked about making a transformation from a chaotic system to a regular system, as if I wanted to walk very regularly across the floor. But of course, we're a mixture of both. You don't quite know what I'm going to do next. I don't even know what I'm going to do next. And so we have a combination of being irregular in our actions and regular. Although we don't know what I'm going to do next, I'm not going to fall down, hopefully. This is a circuit that kind of reflects a little mixture of chaos and regularity. What you've seen, if you've been watching it, is this is a system that kind of wiggles along chaotically and every once in a while produces one of these pulses. And I have no idea when it's going to produce the pulses. It's almost like a stochastic process. It's not stochastic. It's just that this thing has a mind of its own. Usually whenever I talk about it, it doesn't do it, but and that seems to be holding here. But there it goes, you know, every once in a while it does it. So, you know, you can start to get a little bit of, you know, these networks kind of making up their own minds, doing their own thing, which is we want. Okay, so where are we? All right, I want to show you a more realistic example. I'm showing you mathematical examples. So this is an example where we wanted to say, look, can we really generate realistic motor patterns out of this thing? I mean, so far it's kind of been mathematical modeling. So we took some data. There's data you can get over the web, download it, in which people were outfitted with sensors and just told to either walk or run across a space, and all of their body angles, positions were measured. So you can get very accurate data on what the person is doing when they walk or when they run. We could put that into this model and say, can we get a network to actually generate such a sequence of action? You know, we do it by taking, again, one of these networks, having our feedback loops, et cetera, et cetera. Let me just get to it. And then we activate it in two ways in this case. So again, here's the idea. We have the big network is a generic network. We made it randomly. We did not design it to do anything. But it's our basic reservoir for pulling out activity, and we don't touch it internally. Then we add a loop, and that we do cleverly. We don't do that randomly. Again, the red lines here, we choose carefully. The black lines inside that little circle, this other network, again, are random. The black noise going back are, again, random. Then we activate the loop. That's what I'll do first. So that bottom T just means activate it. And then we actually put an input into the original circuit. So we're not changing the circuit. We're just putting an input into it to get a different activity. So let me show you what happens. If I take this circuit and I activate the bottom circuit, and get that loop engaged. This thing has 96 outputs, and it generates in this little stick man, or stick woman, I guess, a running motion. It's looping not because the network does that, just because it's a movie, and that's as long as the movie is. The network just runs and runs and runs and runs. Okay? Now, if we then activate what that left T on the graph, we modulate the network a little bit. What we can do is get, that was the running motion, sorry, I've been saying the wrong thing. This is the walking motion. Let's go back since I can't remember. That's obviously a running motion, I can't remember what I said. And then you modulate it and now you get this walking motion. Okay? So I think we can get realistic patterns. And again, this is a network that started chaotic and useless and has been coaxed into generating something like a walking or a running man. Okay, I want to wind up with just talking about a philosophy of this approach a little bit. The normal way of thinking in neuroscience has always been sort of stimulus response. In other words, you play a tone to an animal, the animal, you know, runs away, whatever, that you have a stimulus response, and that the stimulus generates the response. That tone is generating activity in the brain, that activity in the brain causes the animal to do some sort of behavior. Now, of course, everybody knows the brain is internally active. Not that neuroscientists didn't know that, but they thought of that as a modulation of this basic stimulus response paradigm. Namely, the animal, it could, if it wants to, say, I don't feel like doing anything when you play the tone this time, and it could suppress this response. But it's basically a stimulus response. I think that's not the right way to think of it. I think the best way to think of it is that we generate our responses internally, the way these circuits do. These circuits were not driven by anything. They just generated the responses. And instead, think of the outside stimuli as being modulators on that. You know, I'm going to talk and I'm going to talk and I'll talk, but Jen is going to raise a sign and she'll modulate my behavior and hopefully I'll stop in time. That kind of thing. But you know, when you think about this talk as a good example, this is all just coming from who knows where. And I'm not responding to a stimulus. It's not like the lights in my eye make me talk. And even you wonderful people being here is not what makes me talk. You inspire me, but don't make me talk. Okay, so I want to end up with one idea that we've also implemented with these kind of networks. And that is sort of a sensory idea. I've sort of presented these networks as motor networks that can generate things like the walking man or the running woman. Okay. Here's a different idea. If you take a network model like this, the normal idea would be, if you have a sensory input, just pump it into the circuit, and hopefully something good will come out of that top yellow dot with the red lines, you know, an analysis of the scene, if it's a visual scene. Something will happen. That's the way everybody builds models, including me, until recently. But we had a different idea. What if the sensory input actually is the model builder? Up to now, I and David Cicillo, my student, have been the model builders. We're the ones who adjusted those red lines, or if you believe in the real circuits, evolution adjusted those red lines. But what if in this system, the sensory input adjusts these red lines? What this system can then do is to build a model of the world. Okay, you see, this When we do that adjustment, what we're doing is taking a chaotic model and we're turning it into a model that generates a sine wave or a square wave, triangle wave, or whatever. In this way, we say, let's not us be the boss, let's let the sensory world be the boss and build a model. Right now I look at this room and I have a model in my head. It's people sitting there. I know what you're going to do, you know. You're going to, in the end, you're going to ask questions and you're going to walk out and stuff like that. I have a model in my head. We clearly do that continually. And you can do this in this kind of circuit and get predictions out in the sense that once you've modeled the world, you can predict it. Okay. So let me wind up with again, where do we stand in this sketch? Modeling a brain is different than modeling a galaxy. It's always going to be harder, not only technically harder, but I think there are fundamental reasons for it to be hard. Now, there are a couple of good newses I want to leave you for. One is that I've kept showing a human brain. Human brain is obviously the ultimate galaxy here. But there are smaller galaxies in the world of neuroscience. And in fact, if you look on a logarithmic scale of the number of neurons in the brain, neuroscientists have very cleverly, evenly subdivided that logarithmic scale in different systems that we study. So you can study simpler systems. This is a diagram of the nervous system from a worm, for example. And that's incredibly valuable. The other is that there are amazing technological developments that I haven't talked about at all in this system for looking at neurons, manipulating them, measuring them. And just to show you, I want to compare a diagram. You can see, yeah, sorry, I thought the name wasn't on there. Whoops. I got to go back. I want to compare a diagram done at the beginning of the 1900s by Ramon y Cajal, which is a hand-drawn diagram of the nervous system, to what happened just a few years ago in a project called Brainbow, where now this is a picture of neurons genetically tricked to express these different colors of fluorescence. So this is a nice example of we don't draw hand diagrams anymore. We have exquisite genetic manipulations. So I'll just conclude by saying that these problems are different. I don't think we've made as much progress in the brain as people have made in galaxies and have probably told you about if you went to other talks. But we're getting there. We're making progress. And my advice to you is stay tuned. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Abbott. We now have time for your questions, both online and here in the theater. So those of you here in Waterloo, please make your way down the steps to the microphone. We'll have you speak right on top of the microphone so that you can be heard clearly. And I believe we'll start with Jennifer Dodd with one of our online questions from the web.
Yeah, we have some great questions from our online audience. Barry S. from Toronto would like to know, biology has not in the past embraced theory. How is the field of theoretical neuroscience, especially based on computer models, fitting with the rest of mainstream biology and neuroscience?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I first thought about it, I was originally a particle physicist and worked with many of the people in this building years ago. And when I first started thinking, oh, I'll go into biology, I talked to a friend who is a biologist who said, looked at me and said, there's no such thing as theoretical biology. What, are you crazy? But I would say there's been a total revolution in that regard, really led by neuroscience. Neuroscientists, I think, realize that a system this complicated needs some mathematical analysis, needs a little more. Not to say we're replacing experiment in any way, but so my experience, other than that first friend I talked to, is that people have really embraced it, and there's a really good cooperation in the field.
Great question. Next question, and just speak right into the mic.
Hi, my name's Ronnie Barron, and my question is, do you consider the mind and the brain one and the same thing?
Yes, I do, but I'm scared of the mind, you know. In other words, to make that transition in these models, we can't do it. It would be an exaggeration to say that we do it. I do believe on faith that the physical structure, the chemical and genetic structure of the brain is sufficient to explain the mind, but I don't know how to do it.
Thank you.
Okay, next question.
Hi. I was just wondering whether you believe at some point in computational modeling, whether because we're building on computers that run on completely different principles than the brain, will we have to go back and redesign the hardware so that it matches at a base mm-hmm. level how the brain operates, or is that unnecessary?
Yeah. You know, I go back and forth on this one. You're certainly correct. On the other hand, so I always get intrigued. People say we're going to build neural circuits, electric circuits that are closer to neural circuits, and can you do your modeling on those? And I always get excited, and I say, that'll be really cool. And then computers get faster, so much faster than that development, that thus far that has not occurred. But you know, we may be getting at the end of the standard Moore's law. I mean, in here at the Perimeter Institute, quantum computing is one of the hopes of going beyond that. So that may change, and we may eventually go to circuits that, as you say, are more similar. But thus far, you know, computers have been so powerful that that has not been an issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next question.
Professor Abbott, fascinating talk. You touched on this briefly at the end. How would your modeling change as you move from one species to another? We've been talking about the human mind. What about going down to primates, other mammals, birds, reptiles? Would there be different models, or what would be the shape of the model? What would be the differences among different species?
Yeah, another excellent, excellent question. Fortunately, you know, if you look at both neuroscience and genetics, of course animals are incredibly different, but what strikes you is the similarities much more. You know, the genetic code is so similar. The set of proteins used is so similar. The basic coding, the fact that action potentials are the coding scheme, are similar. So I would say at this point in our understanding, the similarities dominate more than the differences. And the hope is that you go down to simpler systems. Simpler is always a tricky word to use in biology because there is no such thing as a simpler system, but smaller systems. And that information will transfer quite readily up the ladder. And I don't see any reason that that won't be true until our knowledge is to the point where we're really doing the kind of complex things that maybe only primates do or only people do, but we're not there yet.
And another question?
You mentioned your work, and of course it's on the brain, so I hope this is relevant. Would you agree with me that Stephen Hawking has the greatest brain since Einstein?
Sure. I'm in a generous mood.
I'm sure you read his book, didn't you not?
Did
you know he made a mistake in the book?
Well, I think that's a little off topic from
this
particular
example. He made a mistake. Aristotle's theory of earth, air, fire, and water, which was incorrect.
I corrected it.
Thanks.
We can discuss that more in the atrium. I think we have one more question here. Oh, two or three more questions, and then we'll wrap up. So please go ahead, just speak right into the microphone.
Hi. From my understanding of your sort of model, you only take into consideration the synaptic connections. Is that right? Do you foresee that take into consideration chemical sort of neurotransmitter interaction as well, which is sort of more broad, faster, it covers larger areas of brain?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let me just explain what she's talking about is a very good point. Is the difference between chemical transmission at a synapse, which I've been talking about, and really neuromodulation, which are things like what happens when you wake up, what happens when you go into a panic, and all that. That, I completely agree, that is not in these models. It's unbelievably important, and it is really an understudied element of neuroscience, but that's about to change. And the reason it's about to change is that we have new ways of activating those systems. Obviously, what you need to be able to do is to activate those modulators while you're watching a circuit. And those methods have been quite crude in the past, but there are new methods where by actually using light, you can activate these systems. So my guess is that if I come back in 5 years and you're still here and I give this talk, it'll be there, but it isn't there now.
Thanks. Thank you very much. Final question from the audience.
I've always been fascinated with sleep, and it's such a dangerous thing for an animal to do. What's the latest theory for
We just had at our center a talk about this, and although we had a talk about it, my only statement is we don't have the faintest idea. And I totally agree. It's a mysterious thing and an embarrassment that, you know, what something that we spend a very large fraction of our life doing, we really don't know what we're doing. There are ideas about it, but there's nothing really conclusive. It's a great question.
Thank you.
Thank you. And a final word from our online audience.
Yes, I have actually two more questions from our online audience, if we have time for them. The first one is from Tatiana Oh from Toronto. She wants to know, what is currently the best scientifically accepted model for defining what is consciousness and any relationship between it and the brain?
Yeah, I knew I'd get this one. As far as modeling, okay, I'll stick my neck out here. As far as modeling consciousness, once you have this internal activity, you've got something going on in there. The question is, how is it interpreted, right? So this is going to be a slow I don't know. How that internally generated activity is interpreted, we don't know. But that's the subject, right? How do we interpret that? How do we feel about it? So, okay, I don't know. I'll say at the end.
Let me try my second question. Brian would like to know, the superstructures of the universe and those of our own brain have a striking similarity when we develop graphical representations of each. What can theoretical physics and cosmology bring to the study of the brain and vice versa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is a thing that we could learn from. basically the structure of these networks. There are a lot of studies of networks of all different kinds, computer networks, the internet, things in physics, where you want to say, what about the structure of the network tell, you know, what that informs you about the dynamics. So for example, things like small world networks, and clearly neural networks are kind of like small world networks. So I haven't worked in that myself, but I have the feeling that that interchange will be fruitful in the years to come.
If we have time, I'd like to ask my own question.
Oh, the toughest one of all.
Well, I'd like to take your bait, actually, from earlier. You said you had some speculations about why the brain activity goes down when there's a stimulus compared to its spontaneous activity.
Yeah.
So
I think just to clear the way, I mean, it's sort of a signal-to-noise kind of thing. The same, you know, if everybody's talking in the room and I get up to talk, hopefully everybody quiets down so they can listen to me. I really think it's just something as simple as that. However, if you're taking my bait, why does it go back up again? And one idea that we've played with is that, you know, you have an experience. I look out at the audience, but then I close my eyes. It's not like you all go away. I remember you. And maybe that is represented by that spontaneous activity, that the recent experience gets imprinted on that activity so that when it comes up, it's not totally random activity anymore. It's affected by the fact that I just looked out. I'm in the room. All of you are here. And we have models where we can actually do that. So although it's still chaotic activity, it's shaped by recent experience. So that's kind of my conjecture of the day.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Lots of great questions. Now, before we properly thank our guest speaker, a few Quantum to Cosmos programming notes. Professor Abbott will be joining our Physics in the Pub at 7 p.m. at the Huther Hotel. He'll be in conversation with Wilson Da Silva of Cosmos Magazine and several other guests. You'll be able to download the Science in a Pub conversations as a podcast on the Q2C website in the coming weeks. We've been having some really fantastic Science in a Pub conversations all week long here at Quantum to Cosmos, and I'm thinking that one of the stimuli over there tonight might be a beer. I'm
not effect of alcohol on neural circuits. Speaking of chaos.
And the next live event online and broadcast across Canada is tonight's The Agenda with Steve Paikin. The topic is, do we still believe in science? And we have just a stunning lineup of guests, including Neil Turok of PI, Natalie Angier from the New York Times, Stuart Brand of the Long Now Foundation, Nadia Elwadi, who flew in from Cairo just for this. She's the president of the World Federation of Science Journalists, and Michael Griffin, the former head of NASA, all tonight live at 8 o'clock EDT on TVO, on Q2C.com, on TVO.org, and just about every other channel and website you can find. So please let your friends know and tune in and enjoy that conversation tonight. Thank you to everyone attending here at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, on Canada. Thank you to our online audience for tuning in. For those of you here, the Chapters Bookstore at the back of our atrium will now be open if you'd like to browse the book selection. Thanks once again, and please join me in thanking Professor Larry Abbott.